I know it's hard to think of poverty and the safety net as a fast-paced issue, but we're going to have a fast-paced hour to talk about. I guess I'm not sure this is a good phrase, but we're going to try to put flesh on the bones of this data a little bit in terms of what it means to be in poverty in Oklahoma. I'm Linda Edmondson. I'm a member of the board of Oklahoma Policy. I have also been for over 40 years a social worker in Oklahoma, working for DHS, public schools, and nonprofits and medical facilities. I'm retired now, at least retired from getting paid for doing all that kind of do-good work that social workers do. Let me introduce all four of you at once, and then we'll just move down the line with opening statements. Eileen Bradshaw is right there, has been executive director of the Community Food Bank for just over a year. Before that, she was director of Emergency Infant Services, also in Tulsa. She works daily with families who struggle to feed their children. Eileen's a native of Tulsa. Jim Strube, right here, has worked for the Oklahoma Department of Human Services since 1977. He started when he was 8. He's director of Adult and Family Services. There are over 2,000 adult and family services workers under his direction in all 77 counties. They provide cash assistance, food stamps, child care payments, and determine eligibility for Medicaid. That's just a few of the many things that DHS does for people in poverty in Oklahoma. Felicia Collins Correa here is chief executive officer of the YWCA in Tulsa. She's been doing that for more than 6 years. Before that, she previously served as executive director of Tulsa's Domestic Violence Intervention Services. She moved to Oklahoma in 1987. And Chris Steele was introduced to you at lunch. He's executive director of TEAM, which stands for the Education and Employment Ministries in Oklahoma City, a nonprofit specializing in reducing poverty, unemployment, and homelessness. Prior to joining TEAM, he was Speaker of the State House of Representatives, where he represented Shawnee. He is also an ordained minister. Let's start with our opening statements in that same order. Eileen, if you'll go first, and thank you.
I'm going to just speak briefly, and if you have questions, please ask. I'm going to not do a lot of data because it seems like OPI's got all the good data. I did work at Emergency Infant Services before coming to the food bank. It was a job I loved and expect to retire from. But in my 7 years there, I started seeing a really, really scary phenomenon. And that was that people that were working, doing everything that society asked of them, were unable to feed their families. And food was becoming an item that they no longer budgeted for. I mean, they just didn't. They knew when they got paid that they would not have money for food that month, and they started cobbling the assistance together that they would need to feed their families. And I saw that trend inch up, and, you know, I kept hearing data that the recession was getting better, but that situation was not getting better. And I will tell you now that many, many of our neighbors get paid. They pay overpriced for substandard housing many times. They pay a Utotha note place on 11th Street for a car, and which may or may not make it through the month, and then they don't have anything left. And so they begin this really, you know, the food bank works with 450 partner programs, all of whom try very hard to make their assistance as humane and efficient as possible. It's not fun. No matter how hard we try, waiting in line for food that somebody else picks out for you, really not where any of us want to be, right? So it's a hardship. I really resonated when Kate talked about, you know, how folks in poverty are asked to wait and they have to put in time in lines. I mean, we all try to avoid that, but it's a reality. I would open the doors in the morning and there'd be 30 families waiting. We couldn't serve them all simultaneously. And I will tell you that the 450 partner programs on this side of the state that we talk to, that is being echoed in pretty much every community across the state. Nobody is calling us up and saying, hey, we're finally seeing the need for food decrease. Food shouldn't be political, in my opinion. I think even if you make really terrible life decisions, you should still get to eat. I mean, I just believe that. I believe it's the richest country in the world. We should feed our people. Guess what? I am sometimes alone in the room with that philosophy. So it's interesting to me when talking with donors and legislators, sometimes that is not an assumption that you can make. I will tell you that the state legislature was going to do a proclamation, anti-hunger proclamation, and it was pulled because they thought the language was too political. Anti-hunger. So it is not always easy. SNAP, you know, our food bank has now hired somebody to do SNAP outreach so that we can help folks who might have literacy issues or just intimidation issues. How if they're eligible for SNAP, how do they apply for it? And so we've employed somebody full-time to help do that. And that was kind of controversial. I've had donors say, I give to the food bank because I don't necessarily believe in government assistance. But I, in turn, have to share with them that we're working really hard. We had 17.2 million pounds distributed through our food bank this last year. And I don't know if you can get a visual on that, but that's a lot of food, a lot of trucks, a lot of, you know, and it's nowhere near enough. So I have people ask me all the time, should the churches do more? You know, let's put this back in the private sector. The churches, the faith communities, the nonprofits are buckling under the need for increased food. There's no way. I mean, it should be a public-private partnership in alleviating this need. And so that's why we've had to come in and say, you know, you, John Q. Donor, we value you and we want you to support us, but we can't do it alone, so we've got to morally reach out and do SNAP outreach. Has anybody in here seen A Place at the Table? Okay. I really encourage you. It's 84 minutes. I think it's available on iTunes. They have some great data. It talks about the health outcomes, even of the folks who are assisting, right? We put about a quarter of those, 17 million pounds last year, were fresh produce. We've worked really hard to try to increase that number because that's what a lot of folks in poverty can't really afford, and we know it improves their health outcomes. So we've put a lot of emphasis on that. But, you know, if you come through the food bank any given day, you might see, you know, ramen. You might see stuff that would I, do I want to feed it to my own children? No. So do I feel good about asking other people to do that? No. But just like in your own grocery budgets, the higher the nutritional quality, the more expensive it is. So we have this tightrope that we have to walk between having enough food and trying to move the needle on the nutritional quality. And that's a debate that we have really every single day when we're getting ready to spend somebody's donated dollar. What's the best use? Is it quantity or quality? And I'll tell you again that in the same day, I had one of my partner programs call and say, you're killing me with fresh produce. Bring back the canned green beans because I don't have the refrigeration. And I had somebody say, you're killing America with your canned green beans. Give us more fresh produce. That's a true story. Happened in one day. So we have a variety of capacity in our partners. You know, what can they really do? What are their community's needs? And it's not always easy. There's not always a clear mandate. To me, I thought, oh, feeding people seems pretty simple, right? It's not nearly as simple as you might guess. A Place at the Table, one of the big things that they take on that I really appreciate is the subsidies. You know, we know that sugar pops are cheaper than kashi. Why is that? Well, let's look at what we choose to subsidize. We don't subsidize zucchini farmers, right? And so it's a very complex issue. Hunger is very much affected by policy. And so I can't tell you how excited I was when I got this invitation. Bright young minds who want to talk about policy, you suppress all of my friends, just so you know. They nod off when I start talking about this. But there's a lot that can be done on the state, local, and national level policy-wise to impact hunger. But it's going to take a lot of will because it's not nearly as simple or as popular as it might seem to be.
Thank you, Eileen. And Jim Strube next from DHS.
I was excited to be here, too, because I looked at the bios of the people that were going to attend, and I told some of my colleagues that we don't get to talk to that kind of group very often, people that are smart about this kind of thing and interested in it. And OK Policy is a great advocacy group, and we need more advocacy groups in the poverty programs. We live in a state that's pretty conservative and really kind of makes a lot of assumptions about people who are in poverty. I heard someone refer to rewarding idleness this morning, and we hear that all the time in my business, that we're rewarding idleness, and there's a stereotype of people sitting at home receiving welfare and not working when they could work. And it's a much more complicated problem than that. We've talked a little bit about the issues around hunger, but there's issues around poverty itself that are very complex, involving mental illness, substance abuse, and just generational poverty, where people get trapped because this is the culture they live in. And without help bridging that culture and getting into something other than low-income households, They're going to stay there, as you saw earlier. I'm also grateful that Kate had all the statistics and the data, because that's not my thing. I've been doing this a long time, but I came from a middle-class background and came to DHS really not intending to stay there, and ended up staying there as long as I did because I really felt that I was doing something good for the community and for the state and for the country. But I am a baby boomer, and I do come from the generation that did see the poverty program start, and I believe in them, and I continue to believe in them. But we do live in a state where those kind of things, like the word safety net, the phrase safety net, I'm afraid to use it, frankly, in some audiences, in sometimes even including my own staff, because they come, some of them, kind of front-loaded with prejudice about the very people they help. So it's a very complicated process, a very complicated population. The problems are not simple. I think we tend to, certainly in politics, try to simplify things as quickly and distill them down into sound bites and things that do a disservice to the difficulty that the people that we work with face every day, just getting to work or just feeding their children. And I could go on and on about it, but I think the main thing I want to encourage is if you have an interest in this, pursue it. It is really important that we have advocates for this group of people, because our culture does not value this. When I go and speak to new employees that are hired and go through our academy, that's a point I make, is that they're very brave to come to work for the programs that I administer, because this is a population that's ignored, I think in a lot of ways purposely ignored, conveniently ignored. And to work with them takes bravery, because it's an undervalued job. We don't get paid very much. It is a very stressful job, because the people we work with, we had a woman who used to work for a hospital system come and work for us, and we were talking about customer service, because as an agency, we know we've got to improve our customer service. We've got to get people out of lines. We've got to get them help as soon as possible without demeaning them and making them sit through more and more obstacles and jump more and more hurdles. So in the process of talking about that, she talked about a program that's really a customer service program aimed at patients at hospitals and people who come to see patients at hospitals. And the urgency and the fear is very similar to what we face when we see people for the very first time and they walk in our doors and they don't know what they're going to do. So it's very stressful work for the people who do it, and they have to be brave enough to kind of stand in that fire of facing the urgency and the need of these people, and at the same time not really getting much support from their culture. But I'll stop there.
Thank you, Jim. Felicia Collins Correa with the YWCA. We do always need to be using the microphones. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really easier to speak for 30 minutes than it is to speak for 5 minutes and sum up what you want to say. But I really echo a lot of what I've heard from the two panelists so far. The YWCA, our mission is to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. We're 99 years old. We are going to be 100 years old next year, and we have had the ability to morph and change over the years to meet the needs of the community. I think I'm going to skip our service offerings and maybe be able to come back to that, because that might take a little bit too much time. But I'll just give you a hint. I really want to spend time talking about the clients we serve in our immigration and refugee program, because I thought that might be a little bit different from what you may have heard. But we have been about 30 years providing immigration refugee services. The population is from Burma, Burmese, that we're relocating mostly now. It was Russian, Vietnamese, et cetera. We have health and wellness programming, women's empowerment programming, and racial justice, just to give you a little bit of a tease there. But for the purposes of today, the clients we serve who come crashing through the safety net are our refugee and immigrant clients. about two-thirds of the clients we serve through our immigration program are not eligible for benefits because of their status. So right off the bat, what we talked about earlier, they're not eligible for. The refugee clients are. They have a time limit that they are eligible for services, and they make up probably about 20% of the overall clients we serve, and we're talking about 10,000 in numbers. Some of the barriers that the clients face, the primary barrier is English, learning English. And I think it's just ironic that we passed legislation in 2006 to make English our official language for the state of Oklahoma. It was actually a ballot issue. And then about 2 years ago, all of the funding to teach English was cut from our state budget. So there, we've been fighting to get that back. It's under the adult education, and there's zero state funding to teach English as a second language. We do have federal funding, but we have waiting lists now for people to get into our classes. And one of the things we were going to talk about with you today is just myths. And I think that's one of the biggest myths we fight, is that people don't want to learn English. People do want to learn English. They are desperate to learn English. Another myth is they don't want to become American citizens, and they are desperate to be a part of the American dream. Actually, naturalized citizens, we have a project that helps people become citizens. It's called Project Citizenship. And naturalized citizens are the least likely of anyone in Tulsa, and probably this is nationally, to live under the poverty line. So if someone becomes naturalized, so that if they learn English and they go through the process of taking the test and the civics test and passing, and they actually become citizens, they really do better economically than any other group. Okay, soon. One of the another myth, I think, or another perception, is when how people respond when you talked about customer service. When people hear an accent or they hear broken English, they assume certain things. They assume that the person is not smart. They assume the person's not intelligent. And so that's a barrier that I think our clients have to deal with. One of the things that I wanted to, I thought, what do I want to leave this group with? There's one thing I can say of 25 years of doing this work here in Oklahoma and doing social service work in Oklahoma. I stumbled upon this in a book, Forces for Good, and I thought, you know, if I knew this when I started doing domestic violence work back in 1988, it would have been a lot better. But they actually looked at organizations that do better, and organizations that combine policy with services actually are stronger organizations, and that's a real problem, I think, in Oklahoma. We're great at providing services, but when it touches and bumps into policy, and now that we realize, uh-oh, this needs to change because we have 100 clients telling us the same thing, and so now we need to mobilize and actually work to change this policy, we fall short. And in the policy, in the Forces for Good, that is actually, that's what makes an agency a great agency, is combining that policy and taking those risks to create the change.
Okay. Wow, thank you, Felicia. And finally, Chris Steele with Team Ministries.
Poverty, abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence, addiction, mental illness, low self-esteem, lack of education, lack of basic life skills, lack of support, are all pathways to incarceration. Pathways to incarceration. Root causes, and yet as a society, we're not willing to deal with the root causes that cause a person to become incarcerated. Here's the myth, the stereotype, that people who are impacted by poverty are lazy, they are unmotivated, and they are unwilling to learn. Here's the fact. Most individuals who are impacted by poverty are very intelligent and adapt at surviving. They are able to sort of knit resources together. They know where those resources exist, and how to access those resources so that they can make it through another day. Understanding the effects of poverty and the primary causes of those who are impacted by poverty are very important in working with people who are living in poverty. Let me just give you a quick anecdotal story. I just returned from a faith-based camp that existed primarily for children of incarcerated parents. Every child in the camp either had a mom or dad, or a mom and dad who are currently incarcerated. It was a fascinating experience for me. Every child in the camp was living at or below the federal poverty rate. So the camp is a way to try to make sure that the children had a good experience. One of the first things that we were instructed to do as counselors is to go through the belongings of every camper that was to be in our cabin so that we could make sure they had enough clothes and the basic necessities to last them a week. And if they didn't, the camp provided it. They provided everything from shampoo to toothbrushes to deodorant to underwear and socks and shoes and just whatever was needed. Jeremiah was one of the young men that was in my cabin, and he had two pair of socks to last him 5 days. So I went and got him three additional pair of socks. The day that we went swimming, one of the new pair of socks that he had received became very dirty. He had walked in the mud and played in the mud in his shoes and socks, even though he's told not to. And so when we got back, I took the socks out and put them on the clothesline. And the last day, I encouraged Jeremiah to not forget those new socks, to take them home with him. They were his. Had to remind him three different times to pack his socks, and each time he blatantly refused to do so. So finally I pulled him aside and I said, Jeremiah, these socks are perfectly good socks. All you have to do is go and wash them and they'll be like brand new. And he said, that's the problem. It's very difficult for me to wash my clothes at home. He would rather leave the socks than to try to clean them up because of the challenges that he had in his personal situation. Understanding poverty and the issues affected by those living in poverty is very important. About 6 years ago, my wife and I decided to participate in what at the time was called a food stamp challenge. And so what we do, we have two girls, and at that time for a family of four, the average allotment for SNAP or for food stamps was $1.20 per person per meal. And so my wife and I planned to live on basically $21, $25 a week per person for all of the meals that we were going to eat. We shopped at only grocery stores that accepted SNAP cards. They were called food stamp cards at the time. We only bought products that were allowed to be purchased under the SNAP program. And by Thursday of that week, we were all eating Little Debbie snack cake brownies for breakfast. That's what we were doing. There was a result that came out of that. We immediately drafted legislation that would allow local farmers markets to accept and be equipped to accept SNAP cards. The farmers loved it. Recipients loved it. It was a way to ultimately encourage those who are living on assistance to incorporate more fresh fruits and vegetables into their diet. Probably it's not taken off as much as if we would have liked for it to, but at least I think it's a step in the right direction. I'm currently working at TEAM, which is a nonprofit located in Oklahoma City that specializes in providing education, job training, social services, case management, and ultimately job placement assistance for those impacted by incarceration. We believe that a person's ability to obtain and maintain a job is about so much more than just an income. We believe it gives that person a sense of purpose and a sense of belonging in the community. And again, we figure that if we can help mom or dad become successful and achieve their goals, then we help their child's successes substantially in an effort to try to break the cycle of poverty. I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I neglected to say at the very beginning how much I appreciate all of you being interested in these issues. I just want to join, I'm sure, what other people have said, that the idea that you would spend the two heat alert days so far in Oklahoma this summer talking about policy issues and appearing at least to be interested is just wonderful. I know all of us up here appreciate that. I know from my experience starting out as a social worker in 1973 that some of the people I met have impacted the rest of my life, and their faces and their voices still speak to me. Some of them literally from 1973 and 1974. And so I have a question that occurred to me when David first asked me to do this. I said, you know, I'm so concerned that many of the policymakers that I meet at the Capitol when I'm working on advocacy issues seem so removed from any experience with poverty or unemployment or deprivation or disability or cultures different from themselves. How do we help policymakers understand the stories of the people that we serve? And I want to ask each of you that very briefly. Almost bullet points. Yeah.
One of the things that we've done at DHS is invested in the Bridges Out of Poverty program. I don't know if you're familiar with it. There's an excellent book. We've trained our own staff, continue to train our own staff. As you can imagine, there's thousands of them, so it's going to take a while. But we've also part of the way the program works is you go out to the community and you spread this philosophy and this program in the community. So when we have our training, we invite communities in, and then communities mobilize on their own and train others there. And it is marvelous. I was trained as a trainer in it. Went through a 5-day class in it, and it was illuminating. It really is as close to having the experience of living in poverty as you can have and still gain something from it. And I wish that we could get some of the legislators interested in taking it. Maybe some have, but I'm not aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Felicia, do you have ideas?
I'll address it from maybe a little bit another perspective with our mission. Our mission is to eliminate racism and empower women. And we have a program where when you looked at those statistics that Kate showed you, the disproportionality in terms of the number of people impacted by these issues is disproportionately people of color. And so we have a program called Witnessing Whiteness to take folks through a 10-month program. And I have this fantasy that we'll hit 1,000. Somehow we'll get 1,000 people trained, and it'll be just what's needed in our community. But it helps folks, similar to Bridges Out of Poverty. I mean, it really helps, and it's white space only, so it's for white people only who identify as white, to go through a program of how do I become an ally, an anti-racist ally? How do I become an ally to work alongside people of color on these issues? And so we also have a board-level advocacy committee. And so through a lot of the folks who go through Witnessing Whiteness end up on our advocacy committee and then become really energized to deal with some of these issues.
Yeah. And Eileen?
The success that we've had has been limited, but it's been when we've been able to get legislators in a room with somebody who looks just like them but is needing help. And it's embarrassing. I mean, it's a hard thing to ask somebody to do, tell your story. It puts people on the spot. I'm not really comfortable doing that a lot. But if we can get a legislator to sit down with them and really see that, you know, there's the stigma that you talked about. It goes away pretty quickly when you're sitting across from somebody and they're, you know, they look just like them, and they're working, and, you know, a lot of times they'll ask them about their faith habits, and they find out that there's so much intersection that, you know, I don't know that it's made broad sweeping changes, but I do think that I've seen some kind of transformational change just on those two or three people in the room. It's a very slow process. I hope we can find something faster than that.
Thank you. And Chris?
Well, first of all, I don't know if everybody can see what's going on up here, but David Blatt is sitting up here, and he's holding a handful of cards, and there's all kinds of warnings in there, like 2 minutes to go, and he's indicating, he's only holding up one for me, and it says, stop talking now. I just want to tell you, I don't appreciate that a bit. I'm kidding. I'm fixing to brag on David. I'd rather tease him, but let me just tell you that the quick answer to the question, I believe, is this. We have to build relationships with our elected officials. That's the starting part. We have to get to know them and build relationships, and then we need to let them know what is important to us and what we expect of them. And again, I would say this, and we talked about it last night, we need to do our homework, we need to do our research so that when we begin to have the opportunity to communicate what's expected of us and the standard that we expect of them, we can provide tangible, empirical evidence on the facts, and we can move away from the emotions and basing decisions upon emotions and more toward a fact-centered, a research-based decision and dialogue model. I think that that's a real key. And then the other thing is we need to be passionate about what we're talking about. I tease David, but I can tell you that one of the things that makes him so effective is that when you look in his eyes, you know that he believes in what he's talking about, and he believes in the people and the issues that he's advocating for. And that factor, that factor of passion and sincerity, goes a long way in being effective with your elected official.
Thank you very much. I think rather than asking the rest of my questions, at least right now, we'll start with you all. I'll remind you, we are on public radio, so please make your question brief and loud so that we can all hear it, and I'll start with you. The question in a nutshell is, what do you do with people that are using their SNAP card to buy junk food? And that was a question or a concern of an Edmond legislator. We'll start with you, Eileen.
We've started a series of cooking classes for folks that are low income. I think it's an education piece. You know, when my kids were really little, I remember going around the grocery store trying to figure out, you know, the budget. And so I sympathize with that. But there are choices that people can make if they have the information. Cooking Matters is something that we do where we actually teach them to read nutrition labels. They get recipes to replicate. You can make your SNAP dollars last longer and still do it in a more healthy fashion. So we really just need to make that more widely accessible. I mean, and we need to let... The other thing is I think there's a little bit... I totally agree that we want people to purchase healthier things for their children so they can concentrate on all that. But there's a lot of paternalism in that comment. I don't know that anybody wants somebody auditing their grocery cart, really. I mean, I think information is power, and we can help people make better decisions through that.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I was just going to add to what she said. We do have nutrition education programs that are run through, that are funded by the federal government, that we contract with Oklahoma State University to provide, and those are provided for SNAP recipients. At the same time, I'd kind of echo what you said about legislating how people eat. It's cheaper to buy a lot of the food that they see people buy, and that's also food that is subsidized by the federal government. So in a way, it's full circle, but it's really difficult to get right behind somebody in line and tell them what to buy. I don't feel comfortable with that. So that's just me personally. But more to the point is that we do have opportunities to teach people how to eat healthy. Representative Steele brought up the Farmers Market program. We started that actually before the legislation. We went out and went to farmers markets and set up EBT machines there and got farmers markets in the metro areas first. And Tulsa, as a matter of fact, was one of the first places. And try to open up avenues for healthy eating and healthy buying of food with that. As he also said, it's a limited thing, but it's not limited by the program. It's limited by the farmers who want to get involved in it and the small number of farmers markets that this state has, in fact. One of the things, just to get real technical just for a second, one of the barriers for farmers and farmers markets is that the technology is limited, and we as an agency are exploring. We're not ready to start yet, but we're exploring the concept of having I forgot what they call them, but it's an attachment that goes on smartphones that you swipe a card through. We do have the possibility of doing that in the future. That will open up farmers markets a lot more because then farmers can have the transaction directly with the client. So,
yeah. And Chris?
Sure. Appreciate the question. And I think the simple answer is probably education, awareness, and incentives. It's been well said, and it's been my experience, that people tend to become what they're encouraged to be. And I think that there are two basic ways to change behavior. One is through punishment, and the other is through incentives. And so I think if we could, as we educate and raise awareness, if we could incentivize the kind of behavior, not mandate. People in Oklahoma do not like to be told what to do, but if they're asked, they're generally willing to go along. But we incentivize the kind of behavior and maybe reward the purchase of certain kinds of foods, perhaps, within the program.
Yeah.
The Double Up program, I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's some farmers markets here in Tulsa. It's where if you use $20 of your SNAP ability, then it's matched with $20 to be used on fresh produce. And that is limited actually by funding, but it has been very popular with recipients. So I agree with the incentivization.
I just want to point out one thing that I'm sure this wasn't true for the Edmond legislator, but if the only food store you can get to is the one you can walk to North Tulsa or Northeast Oklahoma City, then you buy what's there.
That's exactly right.
Yes. The question is about these kinds of programs, the safety net, why don't they work in smaller cities? And if you consider Muskogee and Lawton smaller cities, I need to tell you that I grew up in Fargo, which is the next town to Gage, where our economist this morning grew up, and that's a really smart, small town that you couldn't even see the safety net from Ellis County.
Yeah. I can attempt to try to address this, and please, others jump in. But having run a nonprofit now for 18, I guess almost 26 years, it's changed. How we operate has had to change as the economy has changed. Reimbursement mechanisms are different. There were times when I was at domestic violence where we were able to get reimbursement for through Medicaid for counseling clients. That went away. So just over the years, your goodwill, your wanting to reach out, it almost becomes impossible. I mean, you know, I was speaking with a donor the other day, and she said, you know, I really feel sorry for nonprofits. They're really under, your accountability has increased, your funding has decreased, and your outcomes have to have outcomes, yet there's no funding to help you achieve, to come up with those outcomes and to be able to staff that. Just in my lifetime, running a nonprofit is not what it used to be. It's very, very difficult. And so, I mean, that's just, I'm sure there are programs in your community and in that community, but that's one of the things, I think. And the same way that nonprofits are under assault, when you looked at those statistics, families are under assault too. And with parents trying to work two or three jobs, raise kids, I just think it's just a difficult world we've kind of created and a bit of a mean spirit to it. We used to want to pay for these things and think that it was okay to pay our taxes to these things. I mean, I really kind of got called on the carpet this past session by a board member for actually saying, sorry, stop cutting taxes. Our state needs no more taxes. And that speaking out was kind of was a little risky. But so I think there's just a little bit of a mean spirit as well.
Here's the answer to the question, I believe. I think the more rural you get, the tougher it is from an infrastructure standpoint. You don't have as many resources available in those locations, particularly when it comes to transportation or housing opportunities, things of that nature, even job opportunities. I think that perhaps those issues are sort of magnified the more rural you get, you sort of get in Oklahoma. And then the other thing is, I think it's sometimes an issue of a lack of coordination among the various entities that are trying to address the problem. Sometimes we become a little territorial because money is so tight, and sort of hard for us to communicate efforts sometimes within a local community. And that's a dynamic that I'm also witnessing, as well as burnout. We're talking about people who have dedicated their lives to working on some very difficult issues and some very difficult situations. And sometimes fatigue, you know, becomes a part of those who are working with it. So I think it's important that we coordinate our efforts, that we support one another, and that we consider ways that we can collectively move the needle. I think that's how we begin to make a difference.
I'd just like to build off of that again. One of the things that the examples that you gave, it's very complicated. Those are very complicated situations that go well beyond a safety net. There's a reason we're talking about a safety net. It catches somebody theoretically after they've had those experiences. But one of the things that we're going to try to do more and more of in our agency is use our presence in the community, because we have presence in all 77 counties, to reach out and kind of coordinate and try to bring together more of the folks that are there to help. as Representative Steele said, there are communities that have limited resources, and they're going to have to build from scratch sometimes. But we want to become more of a presence in the community ourselves and help shore up that infrastructure and provide something other than or in addition to the programs that we administer.
More questions? Yes, right here in the front. The question is, how do we win a communications battle that explains that people are not always responsible for this themselves with, through some personality fault for the straits they find themselves in?
That's an excellent question. We ask ourselves that question in my agency because we've got some challenges with that. We have, as I said when I began talking, I have those challenges within my own staff. Where they feel some need to be apologetic for what they do and to make excuses for their clientele. So we have a long way to go with that, but the simple answer that I have for you is the same one I have for our own agency, which is we need to educate ourselves and then we need to talk to people. And that's hard for some of us. I'm introverted. It's very difficult for me to do that, but it's part of my responsibility is to talk about what we do and why we do it and what the people, who the people we work with look like and you know, just talk about it, I think, is the best way to do it. And it does take having relationships of some degree or another with people and being able to share that information with them.
First of all, I love the Oklahoma Policy Institute. And so thank goodness for and I think in the beginning it was more seen. It was like, oh, they're really liberal. But I know more and more that both sides really understand that the Oklahoma Policy Institute provides facts, and so driving people to their website is often useful. But that's where, and a lot of this, when we talk about poverty and we talk about race, there's some overlap with some of these issues where people get really emotional. And so what we have found with our Witnessing Whiteness program that we've been running now since 2008, that we have people who graduate from it and then they train along with someone and then they can go out and then do a group themselves after they have gone through and trained with someone, that we are finding now that other people are speaking out on our issues that went through our program, and it's like, oh, that is really cool. So it's not just us. It's other people who've gone through Witnessing Whiteness who now get it and then say that they're not going to stay silent. They're going to take action. They're going to speak up. They're going to write a letter to the editor.
I think that, to Felicia's point, making sure that we have our facts right so that we can communicate and create advocates of our friends, because it's a very emotional issue. I can get very emotional when somebody says they don't, you know, they're fat, they can't be hungry. Okay, bring it, right? That doesn't help, and I have to calm myself down and stick to the facts and educate people, because really a lot of policy, you know, people talk about SNAP fraud. I mean, it's one of the lowest incidents of fraud of any government program. And so if you know that, you can kind of calmly, well, actually, weirdly, there's not a lot of fraud. If I can... And social media, weirdly, has helped us a lot with this because we're finding that people retweet and repost. And in the most unlikely places, you know, we'll find something that we've put up. Many times it's something that we've gotten from OPI. But it just, that's a way to kind of have a non-confrontational, very fact-based conversation. I think keeping the emotion out as much as possible. And also if we could get them to ban those comments on the Tulsa World website. That's my personal. That would be my favorite.
No comment. There is a question over here.
I just want to quickly put in a plug. On our website, okdhs.org, there is a link for what's labeled as Did You Know? And it is a wonderful short slideshow about the population that we work with. And it is quite... It is really neat to see it because it really distills down all those facts and figures into something that you can easily understand. It makes comparisons between the number of people that can fit into a football stadium and the number of people that we help every year and that kind of thing. So I'd encourage you to go look at that.
I think the well-worn political cliche is certainly true here. Personal contact alters opinion. part of the problem is getting people to hear those stories or to understand that that data reflects real people that indeed look like them. I'll never forget when several years ago one of our U.S. senators toured an Eastern European country and was looking at refugee camps of people displaced by civil war and terrorism in the Balkans. And he said, I don't understand that these people are refugees. They look just like me. It's a hard effort to overcome those kind of attitudes. There's a question. Yes. Great question. What do you do for the people in the gap? They don't meet the criteria for the programs we've got, but they don't make a living wage to be able to take care of everything their family needs.
We struggle with these. I mean, I don't know about you. We talk about these things all the time. I mean, this is what we really work toward to try to impact in some way. With the divorce rate being what it is and with the disproportionality with women being in poverty, one of the things that we make available on our website, ywcatulsa.org, is an on-your-own guide for women who might be going through divorce. It's not advocating for women who go through divorce. It's just that we have such a high divorce rate, and I think we're number two in the country for multiple marriage rates. We provided this because often it's in the divorce process that women end up worse off economically. So there is a toolkit that we provide. We have workshops second Saturday every month. So we educate women. We have a case manager educate women about how to understand. You know, he just went through the school and future earnings and one person said, well, I'm going to have him help with, you know, in the divorce, I'm going to help him help with, I think it was child care, not thinking about long term, that's going to end, and how do you... So it's really educating women about the legal, financial, if there's domestic violence, a controlling behavior, and how to take care of yourself in the divorce process. It never feels like it's enough, but it's one thing that we do do.
Yeah, Eileen and Jim both.
Many of our pantries, food programs, our partners don't have income requirements. You know, there'll be a self-declaration, you know, what's your monthly income, but they're not accepted or rejected on that basis. So actually, a lot of our partner programs do serve those folks in the gap for whom maybe they've just gotten a raise and it bumped them off of, you know, some form of assistance, but they're not fully whole yet. And that's where actually that... that's where I love the dovetail partnership of, you know, the public-private, because we can, if they edge out of SNAP income-wise, we can kind of pick up the slack and help them there.
And I just wanted to add that we know that there are populations that kind of fall off the cliff when it comes to our assistance, and one of the things that we're trying to put a little more thought into is how we can kind of reduce that cliff a little bit, kind of shear off some of it, so to speak. It's harder to do than one might think, but it's something we're giving a lot more attention to right now, and maybe in the next couple of years we can see some effects from that.
I think the simple answer is that for those people who don't qualify for assistance but need some help, I agree with Eileen. I think that you should probably turn to the nonprofit community and or the faith community. I can tell you at Team, we also do not have income requirements, and we sort of exist to fill those gaps. So that may be, at least in the short term, the place to turn to.
One more question, and then we're going to have kind of a lightning round. Mm-hmm. Is living in poverty a violation of human rights? What a good question. To which there appears to be no answer.
Right. I mean, I love it. Yeah, it is. You don't have access to so much. You're denied. And now, especially since we know what happens, just the cycle, it was, I'm going to blank on the author's name who wrote a book about incarceration. I mean, you talked about the people ending up in prison. It's almost like we've created a caste system, especially when you look at people's inability to move up out of poverty, who are on the bottom. And so I don't think our country's ready to think about that, but I am. I love it.
Sure. It's a very interesting question. And so part of my responsibility is to try to give you as honest of an answer as I know how to give. I think that that's probably a bridge too far, honestly, for the current Oklahoma legislature. What we do believe in is one's ability to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I would tell you that I think the more effective approach would be to consider the impact that living in poverty has on an individual and perhaps focus the discussion on the root causes and how we might effectively address those root causes, which ultimately I think achieves your goal. But that's just my opinion, given sort of the way the wind is blowing right now.
In the couple of the minutes that we have left, in the tradition of many radio shows and quiz shows, I want to ask a question and ask for really rapid responses, just bullet point right off the top of your head kind of responses to a couple of questions. The first is, thinking of your clients, what do you consider the barriers to progress for them? Barriers to progress for your clients. You don't have to use complete sentences.
English, I said it earlier, English. Yeah. Access to English classes.
Substance abuse and mental health problems, I think.
Transportation and lack of education.
Certainly addiction, substance abuse, mental illness, transportation. 30% of our clients are homeless, so housing is a big barrier for us and stability in their personal life.
Thank you. And the second question, you might, you can elaborate into maybe two partial sentences on this one. What are state public policies that are the biggest problem or the biggest asset to your clients? State public policies.
That's an interesting question. I'm gonna tackle it. I'm gonna chase a rabbit very quickly and tell you that of the 20 employees at the Education and Employment Ministry, I believe 12 or 13 qualify for Insure Oklahoma. And so while it doesn't necessarily directly impact our clients, I will tell you it indirectly affects everything that we do in our operation. And until we get this issue figured out of whether or not we're going to accept federal dollars to meet our health care needs and how to do that responsibly, I think it puts our entire operation at jeopardy.
Thank you. Eileen.
I agree with Representative Steele, and it does impact our clients. That's, you know, where you put your money. I mean, there's not much money to go around, and so if you're lapsing in health care, I mean, that's a huge issue for all of our clients.
I think that was really reflected in the videos, too, in Shore, Oklahoma, and I would also add no funding for adult education or English as second language classes.
I would just repeat the word funding.
Funding. I want to thank you all for your attention and your questions, and let's thank our panelists for their expertise.